Opportunities. Tool number 3. Parenting by negotiation. Partner with your child.
Let's make a deal. Whether you're aware of it or not, you're involved in countless negotiations every day. I truly believe that life is one long series of give-and-take interactions, and it begins pretty much from birth. When you cried for attention as a baby and then stopped when your mother picked you up, your first successful negotiation was completed. Later in kindergarten, you negotiated for your space on the playground. You negotiated to win the attention of that first crush in school. Getting your first high school date or steady boyfriend or girlfriend probably required a little more sophisticated give and take. Then you moved into the marketplace and negotiated things like your hourly babysitting rates or lawn mowing fees with the neighbors. Your first car, your first job and salary, and your first house were all acquired through negotiations. You may not have thought of yourself as a negotiator, and you may not have used the word negotiation to describe the process, but that's what you were doing. As parents, you need to be aware of the importance of thoughtful negotiations in your family relationships. The objective in relationship negotiations is, as the carnival barkers like to say, everyone walks away a winner. You want both sides to feel satisfied and fulfilled so that the relationship can continue successfully. In a relationship, making a deal that totally favors you and ignores the needs of your partner or children may seem like a good idea at the time, but it will never last. All relationships are mutually defined, and the definitions you reach are a product of the negotiations you conduct with each other. You may say, "I didn't negotiate this relationship, I just inherited it." That's not true. You teach people how to treat you, and this includes the way you relate to your children. If you don't like your relationship with your child, you need to renegotiate it. Whatever definition your family relationship has, whether your kids are in control, dad's in control, mom's in control, or you all share control, everyone has negotiated their role in the family. Even Sparky the dog, whose tail wagging and barking are persuasive negotiation tools. Consciously or unconsciously, we put negotiations into play in every relationship and in every family. The process goes on constantly. You negotiate the rules, the power distribution, the standards, the goals, the patterns, the practice, and the rhythms of your family. Let's be clear on this. Negotiations are the absolute lifeblood of relationships. Negotiation skills figure prominently in how successful and effective you can become. Hence, it's astounding that most people have absolutely no training in negotiation. Society doesn't teach you this invaluable and important tool, so I'm going to right now. As a mother or father, you can negotiate with many different styles. The first step is to assess the kind of personalities and types you're dealing with. That will tell you what type of negotiation approach to take. If you've got a highly rebellious kid, you don't necessarily want to approach the negotiations in a heavy-handed, badge-heavy, I'm the boss manner. That will only spark resistance. You want to be more of a consensus builder. You want your child to buy in and feel ownership, like it's his or her idea. It's important that your child understands the basics of negotiation, too, because it's such an important life skill for later. From the time our oldest son, Jay, was 10 years old, I had him sit in on many of my daily negotiations, especially when I was buying a car or lawnmower or trying to resolve a conflict with the neighbor about where to put a fence or park a car. Sometimes I even let Jay do the negotiating so he had gained confidence in his ability. One day, on the spur of the moment, we decided to go to a Dallas Mavericks basketball game, even though we didn't have tickets. When we got to the arena, people were selling tickets on the sidewalk. I sent Jay off to negotiate the deal with the ticket hawkers, but first I negotiated my deal with him. "We want to be in Section 3. So we can see the game. Here's $200, enough money to buy two tickets. I want you to get the best price you can, so here's our deal. If you negotiate a ticket price of $200, that's fine. But if you can get him to take less than that, you get to keep the difference. So if you negotiate the price down to $150, you get to keep $50. Jay did all right that day, and the ticket seller walked away a happy man too. My goal was to teach Jay to be comfortable in negotiations and to not get taken advantage of. People sometimes think negotiate is a dirty word, and they get anxious about it. They don't like doing it because it can often be tense, high pressure, and confrontational. But it doesn't have to be. It can be amicable and solution-oriented. Think of it as a process of working together to find a solution. In relationship negotiations in particular, you want to foster mutual respect by treating each other as reasonable and intelligent human beings. I think my kids are really great people, and I want them to know that's how I feel about them when we negotiate. When there's dysfunction in a household, it's easy for parents and children, under stress, to perceive one another as enemies. Doors slam, angry words fly, emotions remain on the surface where they can be easily ignited. In the explosive environment, it's lost that parents and children love and need one another. When you negotiate with your children, you don't want to browbeat or bully or intimidate them because your deal with them is a long-term deal. In a successful negotiation with your child, each of you should come away with the attitude, I can support what you want because this isn't your deal, it's our deal. Start negotiating with the right mindset. To be relevant, do your homework and make sure you understand your children's objectives before you begin negotiations with them. Make certain that what you're trying to negotiate is in the best interest of everyone in the family and not just a matter of convenience for you. Be a good and benevolent steward of your power and control. It's easy to get one-sided when you hold all the chips. Recognize that when you negotiate with a child, they may not have a full understanding of what's in their best interest. Try to get your child to see your rationale, which is about protecting the family. But don't feel guilty if they don't. Over the years, one of the most common complaints I've heard from children is that they feel powerless in negotiations with their parents. Many also perceive their parents to be arbitrary in their discipline and decisions. Nobody likes being treated that way, child or adult. We all want our voices to be heard and our feelings to be considered, even if we don't own the car keys, control the money, or make the rules of the house. Children thrive in situations that are orderly, have boundaries, and are predictable. But at the same time, they like to have a sense of self-determination within that framework. They want to know that they can earn certain rights and privileges if they do what is expected of them. If they feel your position is locked in and that no matter what they say or do, they have no ability to influence you in any way, I can guarantee you they'll unplug from you and figure some other way to get what they want, whether by hook or by crook. Sometimes children who are made to feel inept and powerless in their family situations decide it's easier to ask for forgiveness than permission. They're likely to figure they have nothing to lose by ignoring your rules and taking what they want. They figure, hey, I'm already shut down, so what's the difference? Children often tell me that they believe their parents hold fixed beliefs about how they're going to behave, and there's no hope of ever changing their minds. They believe that if they've made mistakes in the past, been irresponsible, or gotten caught lying or misrepresenting a situation, their punishment is a life sentence with no hope of pardon or parole. They feel destined to live under suspicion and without trust. It's important that children perceive that you're coming to the negotiation table with an open mind and a willingness to look ahead instead of at the past. It's important they perceive themselves as having a degree of power, persuasion, and influence in an open-minded family situation. Children who feel they have a voice feel they have power. Children who feel they have power feel safe and secure. Negotiate with a clarity of purpose. We've all done it. When passing a decision on to a child, every parent, you and me included, has failed at some point and probably at many points to provide a why. Whether it's why the child can't have a supersized milkshake or a Corvette as their first car. It's also true that children will demand a why in an effort to wear down parental resistance. Even so, I advise you to give it to them. Providing your child with an understanding of your underlying reasons helps them learn how to make their own judgments. Your rules will make more sense and carry more weight if you provide a foundation for them. Conversely, they'll have very little lasting power if you simply follow a command model of parenting. My clinical research has shown that the more parents talk with their kids every day and help them understand why you want them to follow your directions, the more you explain things to them, the fewer conflicts arise. There's almost a one-to-one inverse correlation between the number of words spoken in the home and the level of family conflict. And talking confers a fringe benefit in terms of your child's ability to deal with other authority figures such as teachers, employers, even the police. You could say that a parent-child conversation saves lives, or at least a whole lot of angst. A father who tells his 16-year-old son he can't drive his company car to a friend's party is only inviting conflict when his answer to the inevitable why not is, "Because I'm your father and I said no." The kid who hears that answer on a regular basis is destined to resist authority throughout his life. Consider a more appropriate alternative response. Let me tell you why. You're not covered by the insurance. It's a company car, which means only I am supposed to drive it. If you wreck that car, or if some drunk runs into you, not only can't I get to work, I'll be in trouble with my bosses, and if I lose my job, we lose the car. Now, the typical kid may not be thrilled at that answer, but he can't deny the logic behind it. And once he has the logic, he has a foundation for making his own decisions when you aren't around.
Look in your printouts for the material titled Negotiation Rehearsal. This is a simple exercise to get you thinking about the negotiation process.
As you master and employ the art of negotiation, you can pass this critically important tool on to your child. By negotiating for what you want in your relationship with your child, the child will see how it's done. A double bonus good deal. One of the steps in teaching your child negotiation basics is to make sure he or she can predict the consequences of their actions so they have a sense of responsibility for the outcomes generated. If, as your daughter leaves for school on a Friday morning, she tells you to drop dead, then she darn well better be able to confidently predict that she'll be spending the weekend cleaning her room and folding laundry instead of hanging out at the beach with young Mr. Wonderful. It needs to be made clear, when you choose the behavior, you choose the consequences. You'll know they've absorbed that fundamental principle when you hear them say things such as, "I blew it, didn't I?" Or, "My mom didn't ground me, I grounded myself." Or, "If I had just kept my big mouth shut, I'd be at the beach with you guys right now." If both sides of a negotiation don't have requirements to meet in a relationship, there can be no negotiation because there is no buy-in. Once you've made clear both your expectations and the consequences of failing to meet them, your child will get the picture. That sets the foundation from which the rest of the negotiation can begin. Your child needs to know that there are some absolute deal breakers. They need to know that violating any of these deal breakers means the negotiation is over and they lose. Your child will learn that and respect it in order to keep a dialogue going. It may take a few trial runs, but believe me, most kids catch on pretty quickly. Remember, For the choose the behavior, choose the consequences aspect of a negotiation to be effective, it must be wielded with consistency. Once you've negotiated the ground rules, you can't level consequences willy-nilly. You must respect your child's rights. Just because you have a bad day and are on edge, you don't have license to ground your daughter for no reason. Arbitrary punishments will foul not only existing negotiations, but all future attempts at negotiation. Your children have to be able to predict what you will do in order to feel that all-important sense of power to create their own lives. If they choose inappropriate behavior, you must be prepared to deliver the consequences you have committed to. If your child lives up to their part of the bargain, you've got to live up to yours. The negotiation process is designed to give your child a greater sense of self-determination, security, and belonging. When carried out correctly, your child will feel more like a partner than a pawn. It can be extremely helpful also to engage children in making decisions about rules, guidelines, and family behavior patterns. Anytime you can get someone under your supervision to buy into your management plan, you'll achieve several desirable effects. If someone has pride of ownership in a plan, they're much less likely to rebel against it. People who have ownership in a plan are much less likely to thwart it because that would amount to an admission of failure on their part. Children, especially, will gain a sense of security if they feel a sense of power. They absolutely love it when theirs is a plan they can control or at least have input to. With that in mind, let's move to the negotiation skills. Bottom line, negotiation is a form of currency exchange, and the definition of currency exchange has two criteria. First, the process must be overt, not insidious. Second, the methods must be motivated by a desire to further the child's best interest, whether the child agrees or not.
Look in your printout material at the pages labeled Five Critical Steps to Successful Negotiation. This document details key steps, techniques, and principles for successful negotiation.
These five steps give you a step-by-step map for negotiations, but mastering the skills takes practice. It's like learning to ride a unicycle. You shouldn't plan on going very far the first day. The process can break down quickly unless you self-correct as you go. In the negotiation process, this means checking to be certain that at each point you fully understand the other's position. You may think you know what your child is requesting because you were young once yourself and remember how you behaved and even how much you lied. In reality, though, there's only about a 25% chance you really know what's going through your child's head. These negotiation tools are a gift that just keeps on giving, and they can be used in a wide variety of circumstances. Keep in mind, parents, that the true goal of negotiation is to come up with a deal that benefits both sides. You aren't trying to put one over on your children. You're trying to get them to buy into your vision of success for them and for the entire family. When that happens, it's the deal of a lifetime.
Tool number four, parenting with currency, performance and payoffs.
I cannot count the number of frustrated parents who have come to me certain that something is terribly wrong with their children. They say their kids are messed up because they do not respond to standard parenting techniques. These children cannot be motivated, they say. Typical punishments don't work. Timeouts or grounding have no effect. Threats to take away things just don't work. Because these kids apparently don't care about anything. They say their children just don't respond to lecturing or even spanking like other children do. Believe me, these parents need help as much, if not more, than their kids. But when I try to guide them, they invariably respond, "Tried that, doesn't work." Well, there's an old saying, "A poor workman quarrels with his tools." If your child's behavior needs to change, this is where the rubber meets the road. Shaping behavior is a science. There are very specific and precise principles and techniques for doing it. You can learn them and become a powerful change agent within your family. Simply put, these principles work. If you follow my instructions, you can and you will modify your child's behavior in a productive way. You will learn how to get your children to do those things you want them to do and to stop doing things you don't want them to do. I'm going to share with you the how-to nuts and bolts for repairing and fine-tuning your child's behavior patterns. These are tools that come from the established fields of behavioral modification, cognitive behavioral psychology, social psychology, and other scientifically based approaches to human nature. I pulled out the best of each of these disciplines to teach you so that you can create a solid strategy for making lasting behavioral changes that will help you effectively and lovingly parent your child. I must caution you, if you misuse the tools, if you play at this instead of making a serious commitment to learn and apply the principles, you might create more problems than you solve. Understand that I am not talking about applying these tools to those complex issues that may be at the root of your child's unacceptable behavior. If, in your opinion, those underlying causes need to be addressed, then you should seek professional help to get that done. In most cases, I do not believe that such an intervention is required, but that's your call and you will have to make it. In the meantime, I'm going to tell you precisely what you have to do to change your child's problem behavior. The directions for using these tools are deceptively simple, but the nuances are critically important. The principles are based on decades of scientific research and the applications are universal. I say that with such conviction because in addition to a large body of research, the tools are based on laws of human behavior that are as unwavering as the laws of physics. Primary among them is that all humans, and especially children, tend to seek pleasure and avoid pain. I'm not talking about modifying behavior with physical pain, mind you, but I am talking about knowing your child's currencies and controlling them to create the behavioral patterns you desire. If you're wondering whether you have the right to so powerfully shape your child's behavior, trust me. You not only have the right, you have the responsibility. The truth is that the forces that shape your child's behavior are already active. They are being shaped and programmed this very minute. My belief is that process should not be random. There is no one better than you to help your child because no one else in this world wants the best for your child as passionately as you do. But this is an awesome responsibility and one for which you must be a good steward. You must remain focused on discovering your child's authentic self. You must be careful to avoid pushing your own agenda as to likes and dislikes, skills and abilities onto your child. If you are facing stubborn problems with your child, take heart because it is not too late. If you are willing to learn how to use these techniques and, more importantly, how to use them correctly, I predict that you are going to be pleased to discover that there isn't something terribly wrong with your child after all. Happily, you're going to find out that they do, in fact, respond to guidance. 4-year-old Susan was one of the first children I helped with the methods I'm about to teach you. Susan would not talk to her mother. The mom came to me absolutely beside herself, thinking that there was something terribly wrong because Susan would only grunt at her. This child was the youngest of 3 daughters, and she basked in their attention as the baby. But she refused to speak. "I feed her cookies. I plead with her. I spank her. I tease her. I do everything. But all I get are grunts," her mother told me. "I'm embarrassed to take her out to see my friends. I feel like I have a little ape with me." There were several cues in the mother's remarks as to her own issues. And in just observing her daughter as she spoke, I could see that this obviously intelligent child had found a way to manipulate her mother to get her attention. I could see her eyes light up when her mother talked about her frustrations with Susan, compared to her successes with the first 2 daughters. the mother was so wrapped up in her own emotions that the initial session was over before I had a chance to interact at all with the child. Still, I was impressed with how passively little Susan sat on the oversized chair during the whole session. Obviously, there was nothing seriously wrong with this child. Before the next session, I picked up a box of Cheerios and a little child's purse on the way to the clinic. I asked her mother to remain in the waiting room while I talked to Susan in my office. The little girl walked into the office, climbed into a big chair, and made herself at home without a word. She got very interested when I brought out the Cheerios, grunting to indicate that she wanted a handful. I took my cue to begin the behavior modification process. This is the deal. I want to have a good conversation with you about anything you want to talk about. But I know that you want to be paid for your efforts. I will pay you in Cheerio money, I offered. You can eat them or save them in this little purse I bought for you. Deal? I could see that Susan comprehended exactly what I said, but she did not say a word. It was a game to her. I asked her the first yes or no question. Are you comfortable in that chair? She nodded and grunted for a Cheerio. I told her I needed to hear a verbal yes or no. A bell-clear little girl voice rang out, yes. Cheerio time! I rewarded her with exactly one, and she quickly gobbled it down. The next series of questions only required yes-no responses. Susan had no problem with them. Then I began asking for responses in complete sentences. Again, the child spoke clearly and with obvious intelligence, which was also reflected in the fact that she began building up a Cheerios saving account. She stacked them like chips at a poker table. By the end of the session, Susan was chattering like a typical 4-year-old, and I detected similarities to her mother's speech patterns. As we left the room and rejoined her mother, Susan proudly displayed her bulging purse, but she reverted to grunting instead of speaking. I observed as Susan quickly regressed to that undesirable behavior in front of her mother. We had two more sessions that followed the same pattern. Susan chatted me up for Cheerios, but only grunted for her mother. Her mother did get to see and hear her daughter's verbal exchanges with me by observing behind a two-way mirror. Yet she reported no change later in behavior at home. I gained a deeper understanding of that problem when I asked the mother if she tried the Cheerios at home to elicit speech from her daughter. She responded that she didn't have time for those silly games. In a professional perspective, this was a successful case in which I got the desired behavior from the child. But from a family perspective, it was a failure because Susan was not speaking at home. Her mother's failure to follow through should serve as a good, bad example to other parents. You need to understand and embrace the principles of behavior change if you hope to be successful with your child. You can carry the poor kid off to a therapist every year until he or she is 18, but until you bring the principles to bear at home, your child probably will not respond with the desired change in behavior. Now let's look at how to go about creating desirable behaviors. As you go through this material, it's likely that you may realize mistakes you've made in the past with older children. Don't fret, please. You'll be able to correct those errors with the same processes. If you want your child to behave appropriately, you have to first set the standards for the behavior you want. You need to specify exactly how you want your child to behave, but it must be behavior appropriate for the child's age. You can't expect a 5-year-old to have the table manners of a 30-year-old. And you must present a united front. It is important for the parents to sit down with each other and be very clear about how they want their children to behave. They need to develop strategies to achieve those behaviors. I'm going to give you plenty of help there because I want you to focus on the positive. Too often, parents only look at undesirable behaviors and consequently their parenting styles dissolve into complaining and reacting. This is like trying to drive a car by looking through the rearview mirror. You see only what is being done instead of what lies ahead. The list of proper behaviors isn't all that long or complicated. Kids should be expected to follow directions, respect adults, stick to schedules, and act like they have good sense in public, at least. If you focus on developing the positive behaviors with your child, then the negative behaviors won't be so overwhelming, and you can feel good about your parenting and your children. The first step is to identify specific target behaviors. What behaviors do you want your child to begin performing? This category may also include behaviors that your child may occasionally perform, but you want to increase their frequency, intensity, or duration. You may, for example, value a behavior such as reading, but your child rarely sits down with a book, so you want to encourage more of that. As a reminder, be sure to target behaviors that are developmentally appropriate. Reading might be a great goal for a 5- or 6-year-old, but not a 2-year-old. Also, don't make the mistake of targeting an emotion rather than a behavior. A father once said to me, "I wanted my son to eat spinach, and he finally did. Now I want him to like it and feel excited about it." Well, hold on there, Dad. You can influence behavior in hopes that it catches on, but you cannot legislate emotion. That father was confusing emotions with behaviors.
In your printout material, you'll find a section titled Appropriate Behavior Characteristics. This list is designed to help you distinguish between emotions and behaviors.
A positive target behavior is a well-defined action that you wish to introduce or increase in your child's pattern of conduct. It can be confusing to just ask a child to not behave in a certain way in order to receive reinforcement. Doing so would be to violate what we call the dead person's rule. You don't ever want to assign your child something a dead person could do. Think about it. A dead person cannot run through the house, or not be rude, or not talk back. Since you're dealing with a living, breathing child, you'll want to focus on guiding active, positive behavior. This may sound silly, but parents do it all the time. Think about it. If you tell Billy to stop hitting his sister, you may not have made any real progress even if he complies. He can immediately start kicking her, pinching her, pushing her down. You didn't tell him not to do that, and kids will split hairs with you every single time. Instead, tell him something a dead man can't do, such as, "Billy, tell your sister you're sorry for hitting her and help her put her toys away." You have now given him a precise behavioral prescription that calls for affirmative action of appropriate and desired behavior. Simply telling a child what not to do is not an effective management approach. Step 2 is determining currency. There must be a reward or payoff for your child to actively adopt more desirable behaviors. That's not an indictment of your child as being unduly selfish. It's just human nature. Everyone approaches a given situation thinking, "What's in this for me?" At least to some degree. Children are certainly that way because they have not yet been fully socialized to spend much time considering the thoughts, feelings, or needs of others. Children can be both selfish and power-seeking. I'm not saying they are children of the corn-style evil beings. They are just kids looking to survive and looking to get their needs and wants met. I'm pointing out their nature because if you want to be successful in dealing with people, you have to understand what makes them tick. You have to meet them where they are, and with children, if they are greedy, then appeal to the greed. Children want what they want when they want it, and they want it now. So figure out a way for them to get as much of what they want through appropriate behavior. All of us work for payoffs at some level. That's just human nature. What constitutes a payoff varies from one person to another, and for that reason, you must empirically define whether a given consequence is truly positive for your child. You just can't decide that some consequence is a reward just because you think it is or it ought to be. You must determine a positive currency for your child based on what she likes or dislikes and what she is willing to work to get. A lot of parents struggle to identify a positive currency for their children. Sometimes that difficulty is due to the fact that the parent has already given the child everything he or she could possibly want. So the kids, being kids, take everything for granted. It may be that you need to dial their world back down to the basics and require them to learn that television, Nintendo, stereos, DVDs, and an army of stuffed animals are privileges to be earned in exchange for good and proper behavior. Children need to recognize a direct connection between their levels of performance and their quality of life. There are a number of different currencies that can vary with your child's age. One form of currency, for example, would be grades earned in school. I believe it's important to teach children how the world works, so I believe that if grades are designated as an important currency and a child has an A level of performance, they should enjoy an A level of lifestyle. If the child has a B level of performance, they should have a B level lifestyle. If the child makes C's in school, they should have a C level lifestyle. This teaches them how the world works. It also gives them that sense of kid power and mastery and control of their existence that is so critical to the development of a child's sense of self. They also learn a valuable lesson. When you choose the behavior, you choose the consequences. This is critical for learning responsibility. So, do you know your child's currency? Do you have a plan for using it to shape behavior? Or do you just hand out candy indiscriminately because they're entitled? Here's a definition of exactly what I mean by currencies. Currency is anything that, when presented during or immediately after a target behavior, will increase the likelihood of that behavior occurring again. In other words, it is something the kid will work to get. Currency can also motivate a child in the negative. What that means is that children are willing to perform behavior A in order to escape consequence B. An example would be that children will study, behavior A, in order to escape a bad grade, consequence B. Children will speak to their parents with respect, behavior A, to avoid getting grounded, consequence B. I personally prefer positive consequences in exchange for positive behaviors, but in the real world, children will perform to escape the negative consequences or to avoid losing privileges. You have to be prepared to embrace motivation where you find it.
Look in your printout material for the section labeled Currencies. Here you'll find valuable information about ways to identify your child's potential currencies.
Step 3 is administration of currencies. It is true that a child's currency works best and most efficiently when it is given consistently and immediately. Still, there is a science to scheduling administration of currencies in an efficient way. There are two basic schedules I want you to understand: continuous and intermittent. Continuous reinforcements are given every time a target behavior is performed. Intermittent reinforcement is when you give the currency during and immediately after some, but not every, performance of the target behavior. As a strategy, it is recommended that you offer continuous reinforcement during the learning phase. Once stability is established, you should switch to an intermittent schedule of reinforcement. This is recommended because learning occurs more rapidly during continuous reinforcement, yet will be maintained at a greater strength with intermittent reinforcement. Also, a child will have the tendency to resist efforts to move to the next level of behavior or into a new area of behavior if a schedule of continuous reinforcement is maintained. For example, a child may quickly learn the multiplication tables and work hard for both intrinsic and extrinsic currency, but will resist adventures into the unknown when a continuous reinforcement schedule has been maintained. It's not so hard to understand, really. It falls under the philosophy of, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Why try something new if the current and comfortable behavior pays you off every time? How many times have you praised a child for drawing an object only to have the child return again and again with basically the same rendering? They know that drawing brought praise, so why try a new one? Children who are reinforced on a 100% schedule are also very fragile. If, as challenges get more difficult, they begin to experience mistakes and therefore not receive reinforcement, they tend to panic and regress to more infantile behavior. Children who have learned on an intermittent reinforcement schedule are much more stable and durable in their behavior and emotions. They are much more adventurous and willing to try new things in hope of finding a new way to get paid off, perhaps more frequently. Intermittent scheduling can be based on two strategies. The first is time-based. Currencies given based on a time frame, such as giving Cheerios at every 5-minute interval during which a child has continuously played well with others. This schedule is highly effective in shaping target behaviors. The second is the number of times a specific target behavior is performed. For example, every 5th time a child is ready for school on time, an allowance is given.
Now check your printout material for the heading, Shaping Complex Behaviors a Step at a Time. This section gives you specifics about how to shape your child's behaviors and includes a case study to illustrate how it works.
So far, I've talked about getting your child to behave according to your wishes. Now let's look at the other side of the coin. Stopping those behaviors you don't want, such as tantrums and breaking the rules at school. In psychological terms, getting rid of unwanted behaviors is referred to as extinguishing, much like you would extinguish a fire. A blaze cannot continue without fuel, such as gasoline or wood. In the case of behavior, actions will not continue to exist without the fuel of currency and reinforcement. Please note that I'm giving you ways to stop unwanted behavior that will help you avoid conflicts and confrontations with your child. I believe that it is important to avoid confrontation with your child as much as you possibly can. Having head-to-head confrontations, delivering ultimatums, and essentially throwing down the gauntlet breeds conflict, power struggle, and resentment. Therefore, I think it is usually good to try and figure out the best possible alternative and come up with a jointly sponsored plan that both of you buy into and can be excited about. Understand also that all behavior, even bad behavior, serves a purpose. People, including children, only do what works. If you see a behavior being repeated, you can bet that behavior is generating a payoff for the child. Maybe your child wants attention. This isn't necessarily a pathological need, but if he gets the attention as a product of throwing tantrums, whining, crying, and manipulating, that is a problem. The principles of currency and reinforcement are the same for reducing undesirable behaviors as they are for increasing desirable behaviors. Let's look at some specific steps for eliminating problem behaviors. The first step is to identify the problem behavior. Similar to the positive target behavior, be as specific as possible in defining the problem behavior. In terms of attitude, be careful to separate the behavior from the child. Here is a brief overview of how to properly define a problem behavior in terms that make its elimination manageable. Number 1, it must be specifically defined in terms of the observable actions that are targeted for elimination. Number two, it must be narrow in scope. For example, if a child is using profanity, specify the exact words targeted for extinction. Number three, it must be unambiguously defined. The child and the entire family must have a clear understanding of that which is targeted for elimination. Number four, it must be measurable. Whenever possible, the problem behavior should be quantified. For example, counting the number of unacceptable words spoken. Step number two, commit to withdrawing currency. The process of diminishing undesirable behaviors can be accomplished in two ways: direct extinction or substitution of a positive target behavior. When the currency that is maintaining a problem behavior is removed, you can fully expect for the behavior to intensify and get worse in the short term. Why? Because it has been so successful for such a long time that your child will not give it up easily. The child will double his or her efforts to maintain the status quo. It's like putting money in a Coke machine and expecting the drink to appear. If it doesn't work, you don't just shrug and walk away. You beat, shake, rattle, and roll the machine. Call it a few chosen names and consider eternal damnation before you finally quit. Your child will do the same. But if you are consistent in your resolve to really stop the flow of currency that had maintained the problem behavior, things will smooth out. Still, you have to be tough and you have to be committed because you will be tested. If you hang tough for a while but then eventually cave, you will just make the situation worse. All you've done now is teach your child that she has to be even more maladaptive to get a payoff. When you decide to change your child's behavior, make a plan and stick to it. I promise you can win and your child can win too. Isolating and defining the problem behavior is really the easy part. The harder part is getting real with yourself about what you've been doing to maintain the problem behavior so that you can stop doing it. The process of self-examination takes effort. I cannot tell you how many letters we receive from desperate parents who want to come on the show because they have lost control of their children. They plead for help, saying they'll do anything. Their kids may be stealing, lashing out violently, threatening other children, or otherwise doing all they can to live up to the criminal profile of the FBI's most wanted. Yet when I ask those parents to look at themselves by giving them a few penetrating questions that reveal their legacies and their own reinforcement patterns, they turn white and run for the hills. As I said earlier, many parents want me to fix their children, but they are unwilling to look at their own behaviors and commit to changing them. Remember, the family is a system and a problem child is a symptom, an indication that the family has lost its rhythm. You have to be willing to change yourself. This is a critical step toward changing your child. You must be courageous enough to stop enabling the very behavior you want to eliminate. Begin by asking yourself in what ways you could possibly be rewarding your child that might elicit, maintain, or allow the problem behavior. I'm betting you are, at least in part, the currency that keeps alive the behavior that you want to see die. The second approach to eliminating problem behavior is to substitute a positive target behavior or competing behavior for the undesirable one. The process of substitution has three basic requirements. The substitution desired behavior must, 1, serve the same function, 2, be more adaptive, and 3, be a competing response. For example, suppose you want to keep your child from using profanity, such as the word damn. Since this is usually an expression of frustration or anger, the substitute behavior would be using another word for frustration and anger, such as darn or shoot. The substitute must be more adaptive, meaning that it should not be offensive or create more social problems. And it must be applicable to the same circumstance, such as using shoot or darn in the same response.
Now, check your printout material again. This is the time to go through the section titled More Strategies for Eliminating Negative Behavior. This material includes such strategies as the PREMAC principle, response costs, timeouts, and contingency contracts.
Before we move on, I want to talk to you about the child that may be uncommonly stubborn and resistant to change. If you have been a good student and closely followed the principles and guidelines set forth in this chapter, and your child either does not respond or, despite significant changes in behavior, continues to appear unhappy, anguished, or emotionally confused and suffering, you must be sensitive to these circumstances and look deeper. You know your child and their medical, mental, and emotional histories better than anyone. If your child has experienced life events that may have created debilitating pain, fear, or loneliness, it may be that their maladaptive behavior has become a coping mechanism and therefore serves a meaningful and needed purpose in their lives. If, for example, your child has experienced the death of a family member, a painful divorce, or a serious or prolonged illness, their own or a family member's, the very behaviors you are targeting may be generating a protective payoff that goes beyond the apparent. If that is the case, providing them with new behaviors for coping with that internal pain will be essential to their willingness to give up the maladaptive behaviors. You must be patient and may need to simultaneously seek professional help to resolve the pain and conflicts. Hopefully, implementing the 5 factors for a phenomenal family, overcoming any negative parental legacy, and being more sensitive in your parenting style will be curative and healing and act to create a greater sense of safety and security to additionally help your child get past his or her internal issues. Be careful not to hide behind some exaggerated or imagined trauma to excuse your child's accountability or your own. In most cases, children will respond to these behavioral change techniques and feel a whole lot better for it.
Tool number 5, parenting through change. Shake it up to break it up.
I know it might sound crazy to talk about creating disequilibrium in your family as a tool for creating positive change, but that is exactly what I mean. Shaking up dysfunctional behavior patterns and family relationships can be a great tool. In fact, it's a power tool. Creating disequilibrium in an unhealthy family structure can be extremely useful and appropriate if the patterns and alliances that define it are causing problems and are deeply entrenched. That's what I mean when I say you have to shake it up to break it up. By creating a major shift in how things are working around your house, you can clear the way to getting your family back on track. When old habits and patterns all of a sudden no longer work, your child will be vulnerable to your efforts to redefine things. For example, creating disequilibrium is very helpful if you're in a family where it just seems that the tail is wagging the dog. That is, the kids seem to have gained the power. Or it's the girls against the guys, or the guys against the girls. Maybe you have a child who constantly whines and plays the victim, and it works. An imbalance of power, an unhealthy factionalization, can feed the ego and tyranny of a child or an insecure parent, and it can destroy a family in a hurry. Drastic problems call for drastic solutions. In a family that has become dysfunctional or self-destructive, patterns need to change in a dramatic fashion. Using the tool I'm about to present to you in a committed and responsible manner can really stir things up so that you can regroup and restructure in a healthy and balanced way. I call it creating disequilibrium because it results in a redefinition of roles and a major shift of power that can be temporarily very unsettling to those who were running the show and having their way. It forces them to adopt a more mature level of behavior to regain privileges and rights lost in the shakeup. From a psychological perspective, this is a method for redefining your family dynamics and focusing on the priorities that you know in your mind and heart are required to meet your goals of family success. It's like when my mother used to clean our kitchen range after my dad and I had fried up a mess of catfish. Grease was everywhere, and just wiping the stove down wouldn't even almost get it clean. First, she had to take everything off so she could get it clean and then put it back together bright and sparkling, the right way. I know she should have made us clean it, but I didn't know how. I was only 28. There was no neat or easy way to get it right. Same deal with a family that's way out of balance and control. It takes guts and commitment to pull this off, and hopefully you'll have the support of all the adults in the family and extended family. The rewards of a well-run, happy, and peaceful family are simply the sweetest life can offer. So yes, it's worth it. Family therapists will tell you that quite often when a dysfunctional family suffers a major breakdown, maybe someone gets thrown out of the house, a teen gets pregnant or runs away, or even taken into custody, the primary problem is that the teenager or teenagers in the house have come to dominate the mentality and the power dynamics of the entire family. As I said, the tail is wagging the dog. I've seen it happen many times, and it isn't pretty. It can run a family into emotional ruin and financial bankruptcy. Again, that child may be the family member presented as the patient